Group meeting, Saturday, 12th May, 1984. Religious living is the same as living the fully human life, which is the same as living the everyday secular life in tune with or in complete harmony with the great spiritual values. Now, I said human life, and you know how everybody thinks of being human as being, of course, full of errors and mistakes. You have the famous Latin phrase, humanum est errare. It is human to err, to make mistakes. I would put it this way. It is subhuman to make mistakes. Using the word subhuman, not in a pejorative sense, but using it in its full, true, fundamental meaning. This word human has for its root the Sanskrit man. And man in Sanskrit means not only to think, in our sense of the word to think, but to think creatively. That is to say, the exercise of pure mind is the exercise of a creative power. And the prefix hu, H-U, which is the same as the other prefix S-U, su, means that which has been done perfectly and happily, fulfilled one's particular purpose or destiny, as the case may be. So the word human really means the happy, or if you like, the blissful creator. So when I say subhuman, it only means that we, as we are today in the world, the human race as a whole, has not yet reached that point in its evolution. That is what the human race is sort of moving towards, very largely without its knowing it. It has no idea at all of the purpose of its existence or the goal of its existence. Now, this implies that our present mode of consciousness, the way our consciousness functions, will undergo development till it is utterly transmuted from its present state of functioning in terms of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal into the state of the infinite, the eternal, the immortal. In other words, if we want to relate this to theistic conceptions, the destiny of the human is really to become God. Now, this sounds terrible to most people. It sounds very conceited, and one can easily be accused of hubris, pride. It is not a case of pride. It is a case of a simple fact. Evolution takes immense periods of time to bring to fruition what it wants to bring to fruition. And the human race, after all, has had only about 3 or 4 million years on the globe. And in 3 or 4 million years, we haven't done too badly. We have arrived at our present stage of consciousness. A consciousness which, although considerably limited and confined, is capable of penetrating fairly deeply into the nature of things. I mention this particularly because we are conscious in our everyday life of things as such. Inanimate things and animate things. Animate things meaning creatures, human beings, plants, and so on. We are capable of being conscious of them at present only in terms of separateness. That is somebody else, this is another person, that is an animal, that is a plant, etc. Everything is separated out. Now, it is this separateness which isolates us from the totality, from the total universe, which is the great trouble. And it is that which is, I don't like to use the word overcome, but it is that type of consciousness, our present type of consciousness, which becomes transmuted into consciousness as in terms of unitary wholeness. You know how in the theistic religions they present God as being omniscient, knowing everything. Now, of course, we misinterpret the word knowing in that context. In our context, knowing means to have a particular kind of awareness, of knowledge, of separate things or separate persons. But that knowing, because it is a knowing by that which has no brain, God has no brain like we have, you see, and he's the better off for it. Because of that, God's knowingness is in terms of totality, is in terms of the unitary whole, which is the absolute all. Now, that type of consciousness is the type of consciousness towards which the human race is evolving. You have a hint of that in the New Testament, to give just one example, when it is said, "Not a sparrow falleth to the ground, but my Father in heaven knoweth it." Now, he doesn't know it in our way of knowing. We see a sparrow out of millions of sparrows in the world fall to the ground, the earth, the planet Earth. But a sparrow falling to the ground in terms of a consciousness which is a unitary wholeness is something entirely different, because the unitary whole consciousness is functioning in terms of infinity and eternity. And remember that infinity and eternity negate all types of knowing in terms of finitude and temporality. We here are conscious of this, that, here, there, up, down. We are conscious in terms of yesterday, today, tomorrow, etc., etc., etc. All that is negated. Both spatially and temporally, the infinite and the eternal contain an experience and live through everything immediately now. There is no such thing as past, present, and future in eternity. It's only in time that there is past, present, future. In eternity, it is all there at once. It is this at-onceness which is so difficult for our human brains to grasp. We try to make pictures of it. I've done this for years. But you'll discover that in making those pictures, you will make them only in terms of finitude and temporality. Distance, difference, space, time, as we understand it, and so forth and so forth. You see? All that is negated by infinity and eternity. But the extraordinary and wonderful thing is this. The whole of infinity, the whole of eternity is completely embodied in each and every single thing which we are conscious of as separate particulars. The whole of infinity and eternity is in this wooden stand. It is in each one of us. It is in each one of these books, in this cupboard, in this room, in this town, this country, this planet, and the entire universe. In each separate particular, the totality of infinity and eternity is embodied. Don't try to sort of intellectualize over it. You'll find it, at least I found it impossible. But you can get a sense of it. You can get a feel of it according to the circumstance in which you are placed and so on. Sometimes a person, say, suddenly stepping out of the house sees a marvelously brilliant starlit night, and he suddenly gets just a feel, just like that, and he'll actually breathe like that. God, isn't that marvelous? You see, and it's that sort of sense which is the shadow of the consciousness in terms of infinity and eternity. Now, I also said that the religious life is the same as the secular life lived in terms of our spiritual values. You know them all. Truth, love, purity, goodness, wisdom, beauty, anything like that. All right. But of course, that is the end point. But it is an end point which is not reached in separate terms. Oh, this is truth, that is wisdom, this is love. Not at all. It is all one and only one thing, so to say. But the brain functions analytically. It splits up things. You know how if you hold a prism, a glass prism, and get the sunlight go through it, you'll get a spectrum on the wall. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet are the main colors of that spectrum. All right, now the brain acts like this prism. It's a splitter up of the one total reality. So now you see what our real task in life as human beings is. Or shall I say, as members of the human species. When we have realized that condition, which we realize essentially through the constant fulfillment of the great spiritual values, then we are at one with the total reality. We are one with transcendence itself. Now one will say, on the way there are so many good things which one may do and not such good things. Now, as regards the good things, there is one important point to bear in mind. Whatever anyone feels and believes is good, is doing something for the benefit of mankind, do it. Because what you really feel and believe in is what you are capable of at your particular stage. When you have transcended that stage, you will find that something else will turn up, which is the better thing, so to say. In which case, the good thing will have been transmuted into the better, not put aside. For instance, we were talking about demonstrations at our last meeting. If your whole being feels that joining a demonstration is productive of good, join it. As and when change takes place in oneself, and one has grown into a different state, not necessarily a higher state or a lower state. Those are bad words. There is no such thing as comparison in the context of the infinite and the eternal. No comparison whatever. But when you are in a different state, something else, a different action will express that different state and do it. There is one proviso though. One may feel and believe sincerely that this is the right thing to do. But of course, one's feeling and belief may be hopelessly wrong. Take, for instance, terrorism, the phenomenon of terrorism. So many of these terrorists who commit murder and do horrible things, you see, absolutely horrible, evil things, they are convinced that this is the right thing to do. And you see how difficult it is to deal with them, to prevent the horror from taking place. It is all part of the great story of the evolution of man, the evolution of his consciousness. When I am really conscious of something, then quite naturally and spontaneously, it is expressed in all my actions, in my thoughts and feelings and my speech. Because that is what expresses, that sums up the forms of expression of the living person. Thought, feeling, speech, action. You may notice that in olden days, they generally mentioned three things only. Thought, they would talk of thought, not of feeling, but they would talk of thought, of word, and of deed. In Zarathustrianism, for instance, good thoughts, good words, good deeds is the complete summary of living the holy life. What about feelings? Because feelings are different from thoughts. Feelings don't have the sort of precise, clear-cut shape which thoughts have. That is one of their great differences. One of the great differences between the two. Again, feeling is possessed of dynamic power. It is feeling which urges you to move along and do this, that, or the other. Thought comes in afterwards. Feeling and desire are very much associated. Very often they are identical too. A thought comes along afterwards and plans the ways and means to concretely express the feeling. That's where thought comes in. Thought comes in a positive way, that which requires considerable calculation. Calculation with regard to procedure, with regard to method, with regard to quantity, and sometimes also, and often also, with regard to quality. But feeling is the source of the dynamic energy within a person which moves him to action. So now, if all this can be understood, we can proceed to consider what we have to do with regard to ourselves in order that this evolutionary process, this transmutative process, may go on in the right direction and in the right way. And this is where we come up against some very considerable difficulties. As you all know, we are all conditioned. And most people say that the mind of a man is conditioned. But that is not the case. It is not the mind which is conditioned. It is the psyche. What is the difference between mind and psyche? I admit that this is my own arbitrary presentation. It may be wrong, but I don't think I'm altogether wrong, if I'm wrong. You see, mind is an archetypal form in which the primordial creative energy expresses itself in order to bring about manifestation. And manifestation, as we know it and understand it, consists of all kinds of separate things. Separate things, different qualities, different properties, and so forth. Manifestation is of that nature. You have metals, you have trees, you have earth, you have plants, you have all kinds of manifestation. And they are all different. Now, there has to be some sort of formative influence at play in order that this creative energy, which becomes all these things, becomes just these things. And that formative power within the creative energy is mind. And as such, it is universal. It is total. It is not particular. When people say, my mind, they are speaking quite wrongly, I think. Manju, as I say, don't take my words as gospel truth, for goodness sake. Consider them yourself and see whether it is so or not so. To say, my mind is a mistake, mind being this universal energy. But this universal energy, interacting with matter, the body, the living body, produces psyche. And the roots of psyche and psychical phenomena, the root is in the brain and the nervous system, the ductus glands, your bloodstream, and all the rest of it. Now you'll see why the organism, the living person, John Brown, is called, and rightly called, a psychophysical organism, a psychophysical being or person. Now the whole of this psychophysical being or person comes to birth, lives, and dies. And when this psychophysical being dies, he dies completely and absolutely. There is no continuity of that person. The ideas about reincarnation and rebirth and so forth, I reject completely. They are quite mistaken ideas. What goes on is something like this. I, the person who think, feel, speak, and act, am constantly influencing my environment as well as myself. It is said that I, the person, sow the seeds. Up to a point only, I sow. I'm not the exclusive agent of what I think or speak or do, for the very simple reason that all my thinking, feeling, speaking, and doing is very largely the result of the influence from outside, from the parents, from teachers, from friends, from other human beings, from the laws of the land, from the social customs of the land. All these things influence the individual in that situation. And so, he is only the last link, so to say, in the chain of action. Influence, the chain of influence which makes him do this particular thing. He is not solely responsible. He is not an exclusive agent. That is a very important point which, as far as I am aware, correct me if I am wrong, not a single religion has brought out. In Buddhism and in Hinduism, the idea of karma is hopelessly muddled and badly presented. St. Paul made the same mistake when he said, be not mocked. I mean, God is not deceived. Be not mocked. He said first, be not mocked. God is not deceived. Whatsoever you sow, you will reap. That's a completely false statement. Because you are only the last link in the chain. What is sown through a thousand other influencers and people at play, and conditions at play. You see? So how can you reap what you sow? What actually happens, I think, is something more like this. Whatsoever I sow, the totality and I myself will reap. I am included in the totality, so I will reap to a certain extent. But it is the totality which reaps. Now, this is frightfully important. Each one of us is responsible for totality, and the totality is responsible for us. We contribute to the totality and make up the total influences and powers which determine my life and so forth. Therefore, it is everyone's duty in the world, of course they don't know it, it's everyone's duty to be conscious, not exclusively in terms of himself, to be isolatively self-conscious, but to be conscious, to try and be conscious in terms of totality, in terms of us, the whole community. Look at people today, all over the world. Wherever they are self-centered, self-concerned. If they were aware that their neighbor is part and parcel of themselves, and all their neighbors are part and parcel of themselves, what a different world we'd have. Instead of people just working and striving for themselves, they will work together for the happiness and well-being of the whole of society. That is socialism, if you like, in a transcendental sense. What were the great spiritual teachers? They were concerned for our happiness, our well-being. That is why they lived in the midst of so many terrible subhumans and taught them and gave them freely of their life and energy and whatsoever they had discovered and realized for themselves. See, they were socialists in the transcendental sense, with this tremendous us consciousness. There is not a single socialism in the world today as it stands, which pretends to be socialism. It isn't socialism at all. It is only an expanded egoism. So, we can see how by loving our neighbor in the right way can take place. We are not just self-concerned. If one has this us consciousness and not just I and you consciousness with respect to anybody and everybody, then we can easily work together and work for the benefit of the whole. What happens when of course, the greatest example of this is after a war, when the opposing parties meet together and lay down terms and this, that and the other. What are they doing? Are they establishing peace? Not at all. What they are doing is to grab the greatest possible advantage for themselves and keep the conqueror, the conquered, right down with the idea that he may turn up again against me. But then you see, the world has never succeeded. Take the last 6,000 years alone. There have been over 15,000 wars. 2.5 wars per annum. There have been 15,000 wars. And has suspicion and fear on the part of any one nation or any one society against another diminished at all? We are constantly living in terms of fear and suspicion. Why? Because we are conscious only as subhumans. We are conscious in terms of finitude and temporality. And therefore the separate I, we are isolatively, separatively self-conscious. It is that consciousness which has to change. And we can't change it by any sort of repression or force. This is one of the great mistakes made in all upbringing and education and legal systems and so forth, to compel by means of sanctions that which is believed to be good. This is a great mistake. There is, of course, the actual problem: how far can this sort of view be put into practice? People being what they are. Well, we have to try and see how far it can be done. Because people change, other people change, not because you or I have told them that this is better or laid down the law of what they ought to do, but by one's own living example. If each one of us is a shining light, it will be impossible for the whole world to miss seeing that light. See, there is no getting away from that. And light is a life giver. Well, look at the sun and the earth, for instance. Everything on the earth needs sunlight. And it's the same with the spirit of man, with the psyche of man, and with the whole personality of a man. It is what we are in ourselves as we live that makes the difference. And mind you, we have to see for ourselves how to do it. You know why? We can't be told by others. Being told by others is a conditioning. When I myself see that, yes, this is it now, I've got it at last, and I live according to it, then that is going to be really beneficial. There is no repression involved, no suppression involved, no hate involved, no stupidity, fear, violence involved in that. And man is free then. We talk about freedom, but who in the world is free? I ask you, who in the world is free? Free inside himself, and therefore at peace in his mind. Our psyches are full of various illnesses. All the diseases of the world are in our psyche. The diseases of the world in terms of ideas, beliefs, convictions, preconceptions, assumptions, prejudices, and all the rest of it. They are all in our psyche. And the worst elements are the so-called religious beliefs. You know how people, the human race, has believed in survival after death. How and when did this idea come about? Why have people believed in survival after death and postulated a particular soul for a particular body? Why have they done it? How did it happen? I think it happened through dreams of the dead. You know how when mankind started, evolved out of the primate, the original primate, we are the peak point of the development of the primates. Don't say monkeys, because they are just our distant cousins. And they're very nice chaps. As mankind evolved, then there came the stage when the family was a unit. And families got together and helped each other in order to procure food and this, that, and the other. And they made a society. And they made a tribe. And then there'd be another tribe, which perhaps, not having good soil and so forth, was jealous of this tribe. And the final result was war. And the big strong chief of this tribe slew the big strong chief of the other tribe, and then they buried him and so forth, and then the tribes sort of came to terms, but still with hate and fear and suspicion all at play. Now, this big strong chief who slew his enemy had a dream. And in that dream, he saw the man he slew. And he couldn't make it out. And you know what it is like in a dream. You feel absolutely unable to do anything. You, supposing you see a lion in a dream. I've had this sort of dream myself, so I know. You can neither run away from, I could neither run away from the lion. My legs wouldn't work in the dream. And I couldn't do anything to attack him or yell at him, or absolutely petrified. Now this is the nature of a dream. So when Big Strong Chief Sitting Bull woke up in the morning, he woke up in a sweat of fear. But I slew that fellow on such and such a day there, and I saw him. Now he didn't know that he was just dreaming. He would only remember, this is the fellow 2 million years ago, who hadn't evolved sufficiently to know the difference between dream and waking state. And he said, I saw him. Is he alive or is he dead? So the big strong chief went and dug up the grave and found the bones of the fellow who slew. And he was absolutely perplexed. Now not only big strong chief, but several others had dreams like this. In the same tribe, because they also slew some of their enemies. And so they started discussing with each other, are these fellows dead or are they still alive in some mysterious form which cannot be slain? I can't attack them, I can't destroy them. So it must be a spirit of some sort, some mysterious spirit which is immortal. I wouldn't be surprised if that was not one of the powerful means through which the idea of an immortal spirit came into being. There is the real immortal spirit, which is the absolute all, transcendence itself. But I mean, those people never could think in terms of transcendence, which was a unitary whole. They only thought in terms of me and he and he and he. You see? So this idea of the survival after death came into being. And then the people of the tribe perhaps thought and said, you are our chief. The spirits must have their chief also. You know how easily mankind has always read itself into the unknown, into the transcendent. What we do, these spirits and angels and whatnot also must do. We made orchestras, and so all the spirits in heaven, in the Christian heaven, had harps. At least they had harps. We sing, therefore they also sing. And even the great holy ones taught similar things, similar absurdities, I call them. Zarathustra taught, for instance, that the good man who goes to heaven is enjoying himself reciting the prayers of the Avesta. My God, you'd get thoroughly bored, you know, if you had nothing else to do in eternity but recite the prayers of the Avesta. But you know, it never struck those people that such things are absurd. And then the idea of judgment. The soul is called immortal and something separate from the living person here. Now that is a thoroughly illogical statement. If the soul is immortal, it is necessarily eternal. And whatsoever is eternal is infinite also. There is no measure to it. Therefore there is no such thing as a immortal soul. If you regard soul, the word soul, to represent a particular kind of universal energy functioning through you, yes, now that is understandable. But this old idea of immortal soul is absolute nonsense. And the worst part of the nonsense in Zarathustrian teaching is like this. This fellow on earth does so much evil or so much good, therefore the soul is either sent into hell or is taken up into heaven. How perfectly ridiculous. What did the poor soul do? Nothing at all. This fellow here never even knew that he had a soul. I'm talking of thousands and tens of thousands of years ago. But you know, they were incapable of seeing these things. And because they handed down all these ideas to generation after generation, therefore we inherit all this as religious beliefs and ideas and so forth, which is absolute nonsense. Now you see, if we can dispense with all these beliefs, dig them out of our brains, and dispense with them altogether, think of the difference to our own lives. Isn't there an extraordinary freedom? There's no such thing as heaven or hell for me afterwards. Whatsoever I do, I myself here and now, together with totality, reap the fruits of all that I do. And that is heaven or hell for me, insofar as what I reap is something good. And if what I reap is something horrible, then of course it is hell. And then there's the play of conscience, which makes for heaven or hell. But if all these absurd teachings and beliefs are out, then the psyche is getting empty of nonsense. And when the psyche is completely empty of all these ideas and beliefs, none of which have any warrant in absolute truth, then through that psyche the light of transcendence will shine, and it will express itself in one's daily life freely and easily. And each one of us could be a benediction to the world in which we live.